Hey, Crawlspace listeners, just wanted to give you a heads up. We are doing a live podcast in Somerville, Massachusetts on August 18th at 10 p.m. in Davis Square at the Rockwell Theater. Jordan Bonaparte of the Nighttime Podcast is going to be there with us, and we are going to be talking to at least one other very interesting person. So please check it out. There are links in the show notes if you want to buy tickets. Welcome to Crawl Space. Lance, tonight we have a new kind of episode, something we always really intended on doing, something that we have affectionately called the Crawl Space Vault.
It's really exciting, right? Because we did Crawl Space as a way to explore different cases, and then we realized that these cases were going to get us as involved as Moore Murray, with Breonna Maitland and the missing men of Boston and the Dean murder. And I think you and I both have very similar personalities where we get a little OCD about each case. So it's not like you can just cover the Dean murder in three episodes. We have to cover it as deep and as detailed as possible. But what we really want to do, and we just can't seem to do, is just have a conversation. Maybe people just think that we're very morbid people. Like you and I, upon listening to these things, if I didn't know us, I'd be like, these guys are dark, but we're not. Like, yeah, we tend to use humor a lot when discussing and getting deep into the dark matter.
Tonight for this episode, it's a little bit different. We're not going to talk about the Breonna Maitland case. We're not going to talk about the Vanishing Men of Boston or the Dean murder or the Maura Murray case. What we are going to do is talk a little bit about our histories and why we got to love true crime and the darkness. And we also want to read a few iTunes reviews, which I think is something we promised we would do and we really haven't done. So we want to read some of those as well.
Yeah, you just said something that reminded me of a Albert Einstein quote. The most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion that stands at the cradle of true art and true science. And there is something to be said about, people will say that it's dark to always want to talk about the serial killers and unsolved cases and true crime. But when you can make a difference and do it and be entertaining at the same time, I've always said that fear is one of the most powerful emotions. Fear, love, two of the most powerful emotions. You really experience something. People, what's the most profitable movie genre?
Kids movies, actually, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If you're talking about, yeah, like 2-to-1 like ticket ratio, but when you look at it, like, people love being scared.
People pay big money to be scared.
Right.
Which is crazy when you think about it. Look at the roller coaster industry and the horror movie industry as well. Some movies really catch fire. There's just so many horror movies that are made that not all of them will ever make money because they're one of the cheapest movies to make, and a lot of indie producers make them. Actually, we know because we've made horror movies. Pan Man, by the way, check that one out.
Wait, is there a demon in your kitchen?
So, yeah. But yeah, people pay money to be afraid. And one thing that I learned from reading some articles about podcasting and true crime podcasting is that a lot of times people are learning from the true crime podcasts that they listen to, this entertainment, this form of entertainment that they're getting. They're also learning how to be safe.
Yes.
And live their lives more safely than they would if they weren't aware of these cases.
Yes. Being safe and being responsible and being a little bit more aware. I guess that goes with being safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't realize it, right? We didn't realize it when we started it. And when the people started listening, they didn't realize it. So there's a whole onion of, there's a whole, you know, layers of why you listen to true crime and mysteries and why it's interesting, because you do learn a little bit about how you act in the world. And it's simplicity, too, that scares you. When you start the things that are frightening about the Dean murder and the Vanishing Men of Boston and Breonna Maitland and Moore Murray is that everything up until the apparent crime is very simple. A simple man in a simple town, a simple young woman in a small, simple town. Everything is simplicity. And when you take simplicity and you turn it on its head and you turn it into something terrible, that's the scariest thing.
Primal fear is the thing that that makes us most scared. The movie 47 Meters Down that just came out a couple weeks ago, the shark movie. I don't know if you know the premise of this movie.
Yeah.
But these two women on vacation, they hop into a shark cage, like one of these things where you can get close to sharks and view them. And they're in this cage together and they're lowered down and these sharks are around them. The people throw out blood and meat and the sharks are there, but the line snaps and the cage trapped, it's you know, locked still, and it falls all the way down to the bottom of the ocean floor, 47 meters down. And so there's so much primal fear in that one premise. I've told a few people that and they said I've gotten anxiety just hearing you tell me that premise.
Do you know what else makes you feel fear? That they use meters and not feet, because it wouldn't sound the same, right? It wouldn't sound the same if they said like 5,700 feet down, you know, right. Or whatever I can hear people emailing me right now to let me know how many. It's probably, what is it?
I think it's 3 feet per meter.
It's like 3.3 feet per meter. So yeah. Do the friggin' math and you got what I'm saying.
We never promised anyone math on this show.
We didn't. Well, actually we did not. We never did. But yeah, I mean you if it was called like 242 feet down, it wouldn't be as frightening. Meters just sounds more frightening.
But I just find it interesting because that movie is sort of like summer movie. It's a little bit of a B movie type, the way it's made. The reviews were tepid. But then there's a movie like It Comes at Night that is a horror movie that horror fans are going nuts for, and the reviews are incredible for it, but it didn't do nearly as well as 47 Meters Down. The primal fear of the premise of 47 Meters Down really played, and something about It Comes at Night didn't get people to the theater on that primal level. It may be a scarier movie, I don't know, I haven't seen it yet, but it didn't do as well at the box office.
People love sharks.
Yeah, people really do.
And I'm probably not inaccurate when I say the leads were probably in bathing suits.
Yeah, I think you'd be right. Yeah, that'd be accurate.
Yep. So you got some sharks, yeah. You got some bikinis, you got some blood. I mean, that's box office right there.
So let's get into our substance here, Lance. Let's talk about you real quick and you growing up, because I know you were affected in some interesting ways by a murder that took place in the town next to where you grew up. You know, tell us a little bit about that, and then I'll go into sort of my early life into the idea of crime.
I remember growing up in a small town in New Hampshire. Same town that William Dean was murdered in. This was not the murder that first attracted me to true crime, or I guess subconsciously attracted me to true crime. The town is Jaffrey, New Hampshire. I grew up there, and I was just about 10 years old when I first heard of the murder of Craig Lane. And Craig Lane was a 17-year-old high school student. He grew up in the town of Peterborough, New Hampshire, went to the rival high school that my sister went to, the one in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, Conant High School, and he went to Conval High School. And they were sort of pseudo-rivals. He worked at a gas station in a small shopping center plaza parking lot, and it was one of those gas stations that they don't really make anymore. I think there were maybe two or three pumps. There was the little kiosk in the middle. And for the most part, it was wide enough and long enough for a desk and somebody to sit and be behind the register. And one night in January, a father and his young daughter pulled up to see somebody running out. His image was visible in their headlights. The daughter and both the father saw the face, and then the perpetrator, ran across the street and into the woods. they went up closer to this kiosk and discovered the body of Craig Lane, who had been stabbed multiple times. The cash register was open. It turns out a small amount of money, of cash, was grabbed, along with some receipts, some various random receipts. The perpetrator ran to, I don't know if you remember Ames.
Oh, yeah.
Ames was a department store.
Zayers before that.
Zayers, yeah. If you Zayers. It was really the Amazon of the 80s. yeah, before Walmart, there was Zayers and Ames and Kmart. The perpetrator ran into Ames, which was across the street, down a small road. I would say if you were to go like point A to point B, it's maybe half mile. He went in, he grabbed a couple of women's sweatshirts from one of the racks, put them on. They didn't fit at all. He had blood stains on his hands and everything. This is back in the day. Apparently there was no security camera that was either working or working well enough to get a good image of the perpetrator. He paid at the register for these for the sweatshirts, and then he disappeared. And it's been unsolved to this day. There are plenty of rumors in the town about who did it. A lot of speculation. I was too young to really understand how it affected the town. Right now, I could probably start talking to my family and to the people who were related to Craig Lane. But what stood out to me, pretty much the crucial pivotal moment in my true crime subconscious addiction, was when I was walking to school. And I say walking to school, and I think I'm making that up. I was just kind of walking, but I think it sounds better to say I was walking to school. on like a January or February morning.
Yeah, probably lighting firecrackers walking away from school.
Right, yeah, lighting firecrackers and
smoking Lucy's.
Smoking Lucy's. Smoking Lucy's, rolling my Lucy's and you know, calling the cops pigs and running away. I saw the composite sketch of the perpetrator in Craig Lane's murder, and it was in one of the small, I think the store was called B&B Grocery, and it was in the little breezeway between the main entrance and the store entrance. And the composite sketch absolutely terrified me in its simplicity, in its nondescript, featureless face. And if you can think of something like maybe the Michael Myers mask, how that's creepy in just its featureless, emotionless face. And it was, I remember looking at it, and then I remember dreaming about this for, I don't even know when I stopped dreaming about it. I think I still do dream about it. Years later, I was talking to one of my best friends that I grew up with and I still keep in touch with. His name's Jason, and I was talking to him about it, and this was maybe 6 years ago. And I said, remember that Craig Lane murder composite sketch? And he was like, dude, that scared the shit out of me. That's that composite sketch, and it just embedded itself in all of our brains, this composite sketch. So we looked online. My first reaction was, maybe as a kid, I saw this a lot differently because it didn't look the same. And it's funny how things come full circle, because when we first met Ryan, who was our Dean murder expert in episode 2, he brought up the Craig Lane murder during one of our town hall type meeting with the Dean murder research group by saying, you guys should check out the murder of this young man who was stabbed to death in Peterborough, New Hampshire. And I said, Craig Lane? And he said, yeah. And I started talking to him about this composite sketch and how it looked different. And he gave me the background to it. He said that over the years, when computer imaging enhanced, they were able to come up with a better composite sketch than the one that was originally out there. And I guess it is better in the sense that it has more features to it. But I do remember that first one being the one that stuck in my memory and really got me, really put me into this like dark circle of, you know, I got into Stephen King, I got into horror movies, and that was what started the whole thing. And apparently that composite sketch was the description of the young girl in the car who was with her father when they pulled up to the scene. That's what I heard. Which would be interesting to talk to her at this time.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's definitely a case to look into down the line. With your personal connection to it, I think it could be an interesting case to cover.
At this time in my life, I'm glad that I wasn't 5 or 7 years older, because that would make me 5 or 7 years older right now. But I wish I would have been a little more aware of how it affected my oldest sister and my second oldest sister, because I'm the youngest of three sisters. I would have liked to have been a little bit more aware of how that affected them being adolescents and in high school, and whose finger is being pointed at who, you know? And
yeah, I picture Woodsville High from Scream.
Sure, a lot of that, right? You picture a lot of that, you know. Someone walks through the halls and then everyone kind of turns to their friend at the locker and they're like, you know?
Yeah, I mean, everyone must have been, like, had an opinion on who it was.
I've talked to my sisters briefly about it, but, you know, that was back in a different time. I was, people were a little bit more resourceful back then. They had a little bit less time to chat, I think. I don't know how to describe it. I feel like there was some talk, but people were just kind of doing more things, especially in a small town. People were going to the basketball games and cruising around town. And
yeah, I would argue that they did less back then. The going to the basketball game doesn't seem like a lot. You got email now on your phone. You got to get back to people. You got text. The world's a lot more complicated now.
No, that's what I'm saying. The world is a lot more complicated, but the world is more connected. I think they were not as like connected socially, where they could quickly like put a bunch of ideas out there. You know, if Craig Lane's murder was talked about, it was talked about, and then it was like, oh, are you going to the basketball game tonight? What are you doing tonight? I keep using basketball just because it's a solid example. And what was said about it amongst 17, 18, 19-year-olds was just said. It wasn't written in a Facebook post. You know, it wasn't always out there for everybody to see. So I feel like if there was Facebook back then, or Twitter, social media, and someone put on their Facebook page their theory about Craig Lane's murder, it would be there for a long time. If someone just said it in the cafeteria, then it just kind of gets forgotten about in a few months or a couple years.
So yeah, I think that might be something to dig into down the line.
My fear is that we dig into too much in New Hampshire and we start making New Hampshire look like a fucking dangerous state. Not like our words have such power that people would stop going to New Hampshire.
Yeah, we'd affect the tourist industry. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at the recording time here, and I think I've just absolutely rambled for about 18 minutes straight. And if anyone's still listening to this, they can hear how you got involved in the true crime arena.
Oh, thanks for letting me talk.
Oh, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, Lance Reinstern here, and my special guest, Tim Paliri, and he's going to bore us all with his story about how he got involved in true crime almost as much as I did.
Oh, thank you.
Sound effect? Is that our first official sound effect?
Don't talk over it. So my mom was pretty big into true crime and serial killers and that kind of thing. And when I was 12 or 13, whenever The Silence of the Lambs came out on video, I remember going to Blockbuster every day, every weekday, and found that it was all sold out. And me and my mom was dragging me there. This was like 5 days in a row, and we finally ended up renting it. And this is, you know, back in 1993. This is a 12-year-old Timmy. But my mom was really into true crime, and her sisters are too still. But she met Albert DeSalvo at one point. Her friend introduced her to him, and the story is a little bit lost in folklore in the annals of my family at this point. I'm not even sure how I could track this story down.
In the what of your family?
The annals of my family, you know, like the annals of history. I don't know how I may have to try to learn a little bit more about this instance, but this was what I've known my entire life, is that my mom shook Albert DeSalvo's hand. And of course, who is Albert DeSalvo, Lance?
Albert DeSalvo is allegedly the Boston Strangler.
Or one of the Boston Stranglers, depending on what you read or hear about.
Exactly.
It. Of course, is a very popular podcast on the Boston Strangler now.
Let me ask you a question. Your mother shook Albert DeSalvo's hand. Albert DeSalvo, or the Boston Stranglers, I would say, reign of terror in Boston lasted 2 years, from June of 62 to January of 64. That's when 13 women were found strangled, allegedly, by the Boston Strangler, who allegedly was Albert DeSalvo. When did your mother shake the alleged Boston Strangler's hand?
I'm not sure. Do you know when he was arrested?
I think it was 1964. It was October of 1964. He confessed to his attorney, who happened to be standing right above the Crawl Space banner at CrimeCon 2017, purely by accident, F. Lee Bailey.
Right. Yeah, but that's a good question. I'm not sure. Now I'm starting to think, well, the story doesn't sound that real, because my mom would have been like 10 years old, 11 or 12 years old maybe back then. But that is the story as I knew it. I heard she was introduced to Albert. It was a friend. So it must have been a friend of her mom's or dad's. And actually, speaking of my mom's mom was roommates with the Black Dahlia at one point in her life. And that is 100% true.
Elizabeth Short and my grandmother, Eleanor McBride, were roommates for a very short period. At one point, Elizabeth Short lived in Medford, Mass., which is the same city I grew up in.
Right. Your grandmother met the Black Dahlia, was roommates with the Black Dahlia. What was your grandmother's name again?
Eleanor McBride. Or actually, I suppose it would have been Howard back then.
No, let's stick with Eleanor McBride, because that's like I feel like she wrote like Pride and Prejudice. Pride and Prejudice by Eleanor McBride. This is crazy. This is crazy. Your mother, which I buy this, though. I mean, she didn't have to be in her 20s or 30s to shake anyone's hand. She could have been introduced to somebody. Albert DeSalvo was... I mean, he was the man who's labeled the Green Man, who would knock on women's doors. He would case women's apartments and homes and knock on their doors and say, claim that he was there to fix the air conditioning unit or their garbage disposal in their sink. And then he would fondle them. He would sexually assault them. He was arrested for that. And it wouldn't surprise me if he met your mother or somebody that your mother knew, or your grandfather on your mother's side, somewhere along the lines. I mean, it's Medford and Malden and Everett and Boston back in the 60s. It's a small world now. It's a very small world then. I could imagine something like that could happen.
So I checked this out with my dad, and he said both of these stories are true. He said he's not sure if my grandmother lived with Elizabeth Short, but he did know that she knew her. And my mom had a friend whose uncle was Albert DeSalvo, and she was over her friend's house, and her friend introduced him to her. He said it may have only been once.
And that puts your mom's age at what we're saying, like, she's young, right? 9, 10, 11-ish?
Yes, exactly.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny when you start remembering these things? The way we decided to do this episode was to just have a conversation, because we never really have a conversation. We always approach something. Every episode that we work on, we have some sort of guideline that we're going by. But this one, we were like, let's talk about serial killers. Let's talk about how we're getting started in this. And yeah, I didn't realize what I remembered about the Craig Lane murder. And now, you know, all of a sudden we've realized that your mother was probably 10 or 11 when she shook Albert DeSalvo's hand, and your grandmother was roommates with the Black Dahlia, which is bananas.
You want to hear another one?
That's why I'm here.
I played basketball at Barry Park in Medford, Mass. when I was probably 12 or 13, and maybe 14 or 15, and there was a couple of kids from Somerville. It was a 2-on-2 game. I don't even remember the friend that I had with me. I could make some guesses, but we played a couple of kids from Somerville. One of the kids, not long after that, was arrested and charged with murder, murdering his best friend's mother. He's still in jail today. His name's Eddie O'Brien.
No kidding.
He was 6'4", 260 pounds. He was 15 in July of 1995 when he was arrested and convicted of first-degree murder.
You played basketball against him.
I played basketball against him, yeah.
Who won?
I don't remember that. I could lie or exaggerate, but I don't remember that one. And I actually don't even remember how this dawned on me and my friend that we played ball with this kid. I mean, it wasn't a typical thing that people from other cities kind of straggle down to your park. Usually at the park and on a summer afternoon, it was the same kids every day. So, you know, you probably got to talking to these guys a little bit. They're from Somerville. My name's Eddie. His friend was there. I forget who. I mean, I remember Eddie being huge and not nice. You know, I was more slender than I am now. And this guy was throwing his body around at us. I'm pretty sure they won. He was 6'4".
Yeah, it sounds like I got a feeling, yeah, though, where the game went, where the direction of the game went. Now, were you slender with the Kennedy hair and the piercing green eyes still, or had that not developed yet?
I will say the eyes were there, but the Kennedy hair was not in full effect at that point.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. How old, you were what, 15?
I would have been 14 or 15, yeah.
Kennedy didn't even have Kennedy hair at 14 or 15.
That's right.
Yeah. Don't beat yourself up over it.
But I actually Google this guy in this case once in a while because I'm just kind of curious about it. Maybe that's natural. But there's a chance he gets out pretty soon, Edward O'Brien.
I wonder if he listens to podcasts in prison.
I don't know. Actually, I'm looking at one article here, and it says that he's not even guilty. Said he spent over 22 years behind bars. By all accounts, he is positive and mentally healthy. He has daily contact with family and friends. He is a voracious reader, a maturing writer, and is well-informed regarding world events. So maybe he does listen to podcasts. He also joins with others twice a week to say the rosary. This is an article from the Somerville Times by William Shelton back in January of this year.
Does it say that he's an avid pickup basketball player?
Once played against Crawlspace's Tim Pillary and dominated him.
but he walked away from that game and he said, "Man, that boy's got an olive oil voice. That boy's not a basketball player."
But if memory serves correctly, I think what happened was my friend who I was on the same team with, like called me or you know, he would actually just drop by and knock on the door, see if I was home. That those were the days, 1994, 1995. But he said, you know, did you see that news report about the guy in the paper? And I said, no. And he said, you know, the guy we played basketball with, like, and this was like no more than a few weeks or a month after we had played basketball with them. And I said, yeah, he said he killed his friend's mother, which happened to be his neighbor, too. And I do remember reading a lot about this case back then and that he was spotted by a neighbor and that he saw the neighbor looking at him and he smiled back and then he took off. And that terrified me as a young kid.
Right, because you hear that he smiled back like an evil smile. It was probably like an ear to ear smile with fangs in your brain, right? It was, exactly. You know, like his eyes went black and he, you know,
right. Vanished then, into a cloud of smoke. Yeah.
Yeah. And he did like the finger across the throat thing and then, you know, leapt away and crawled up a tree or something, scampered, did like a backwards crab walk away.
Well, you know, your brain will do some interesting things to you, especially after you read that this guy allegedly stabbed his best friend's mother 98 times.
How, 98 times? That's just pure rage. I mean, this isn't like, was this a robbery that went wrong? And 98 times.
Yeah.
You could probably stab somebody twice in a second, right?
Yeah.
98 times. Look at this. We just suddenly got to see. This was supposed to be a lighthearted.
Let's take a moment of silence and play this music here for about a minute. Kind of lost count, but that's less than a minute.
It's still less than a minute.
Yeah, I mean, that's just incredible that one human being can do that to another person. And every time I hear stories like this, it creeps me out. And the saddest thing about it is thinking of what the person who is getting killed is thinking right before they die, and they realize that they're gonna die, and it's at the hands of this monster. And they don't want to die.
That is incredible. This randomness, right? You think about this like that. That with Craig Lane's murder, he was stabbed. I forgot what it was. He was stabbed multiple times in the throat. He was working his night job. He was just working. He was 17 years old. He was probably, I don't know, reading a magazine or something, and this random person comes in and robs him, and doesn't have to just, I mean, if you Google the Craig Lane murder, you'll see what Craig Lane looks like. He looks like a good kid. He's clean cut. He's got glasses. His father was the chief of police. And he was just there working. And one second, just trying to keep warm. Right, it's January, and then the next second, he's just bleeding out. Yeah, what goes through someone's head when that's happening? 98 times is goddamn ridiculous. Why are they saying that he might be innocent?
I'd have to read more into it. Maybe that's something we can dive into a little bit later on down the line too. But there is a quote here in the same article from Judge Heffron, who is now 84 years old. He's quoted as saying, "I hope I'm alive to see him walk out of jail."
Hmm.
Boston College Law School's Innocence Program has accepted Eddie's case for review. So maybe it is something to dig into a little bit down the line. I mean, this is maybe even a guy we could get on the show down the line. I'm sure he wouldn't remember the ass whooping that I laid on him on the basketball court that day, but we could certainly ask him about it.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the primary focus of the interview, which would be to really focus on your pump fake, which is nasty.
Do you know how many points Tim scored against you that day,
yeah,
Eddie?
Yeah, how many?
We've only got a couple more questions and a few more minutes here.
How many times did he freeze you in your Nike Airs? He froze you. He faked you and then went in for the layup. Did that happen multiple
Dunk.
Times? Well, I just pictured you like not wanting to totally humiliate him. But yeah, that would be the primary focus of the interview, and then we'd have some auxiliary questions about his alleged misconviction of this crime.
And I'd love to know what he was thinking when he did this too. I mean, if he really did do it, of course, but wouldn't it be great to get a murderer's honest answer on that?
Right. You're saying, let's say he actually did it and he's let out of prison because he served his time and he found God, which is, doesn't that seem like just like an easy thing?
It's a little cliche.
Yeah, but isn't it easy to be like, he prays to the rosary five times a day? Awesome. Super. Yeah, we should get him on. We should make sure that he actually loves Jesus now. We should shoot something where he's playing one-on-one with you. And then we'll start talking about his perhaps wrongful conviction.
Are there any cases, Lance, that really kind of turn your crank still at this point in your life? And, because I have one, and I'm just curious if there's any cases, maybe they're high profile, maybe they're not, things that really just make you curious and want to dig in.
You know, I I feel like everything that we're working on, I mean, the Boston Strangler, just because it's local and it was one of the first serial killers that I mean, in the 60s, it was one of the first high profile serial killers in America. They all, as you say, turn my crank. My crank is easily turned. There's a chance I'm turning it now. But I do know that there's the matter of Albert Fish, which you've always expressed interest in, and a completely horrific person. I think that's a pretty decent segue to talk about Albert Fish.
Yeah, he's a real motherfucker, real monster who killed kids. Albert Fish was a serial killer who was alive in the early part of last century, from 1870 to 1936, when he was electrocuted in Sing Sing. He was known as the Werewolf of Wisteria, the Brooklyn Vampire, the Moon Maniac, the Gray Man, and of course, the Boogeyman.
He's known as the Moon Maniac? The Werewolf, the Gray Man. You can say werewolf and you can say Moon Maniac, and that's like kind of creepy to me, but why is it that Gray Man is the... Now, I have in front of me why he is allegedly known as the Gray Man. Francis McDonald, who was 8 years old, was playing on the porch with his mother, and a gray-haired man who appeared to be frail, an old man, was walking down the street muttering to himself. The mother noticed and didn't report anything, because why would you, right? But later that day, Francis was playing in the park. His friends noticed that he walked into the woods with an elderly gray-haired man. So when Francis McDonald was missing and found in the woods, badly beaten and strangled with his own suspenders, this gray-haired man kept coming up in conversation. So that's how we got the Gray Man moniker.
This guy got on my radar after watching a documentary about him. I think it was called Albert Fish. It was a 2007 documentary that I was kind of terrified by, actually. But really, it's the letters that he wrote to the parents of the kids that he killed. It's really the most disturbing thing that I think I can point to that I know that any serial killer has done. The letter that Albert Fish wrote to the mother of Grace Budd, a little girl that he killed, was sent while he was already in prison. And that one, I honestly can't read. It's too disturbing. I have a daughter. I can't do it.
Yeah, seriously. You look at what this guy is about, as nasty as they come. He has discussed the details of murdering one of the young boys, and with pleasure seems to be describing how he tied him up and beat him. And he might be making this up, but even if you make this part up, you're totally fucked up. He admits to drinking his blood and making a stew out of his body parts. This is psychosis on a whole nother level. This is psychopathic. We talk a lot about, right, like the being a psychopath or a sociopath, and I wonder what this dude scored on the psychopath test. He must have scored like a 50.
Yeah, he was off the charts. There's no question about it. This letter that Fish wrote to his attorney is a little bit easier for me to read. But I think we should go through it and just kind of point out how awful it is. He says, "I brought him to Riker Ave dump. There was a house that stands alone not far from where I took him. I took the G-boy there," the G-boy meaning Billy Gaffney.
That's who he claims to have drank the blood of.
Yeah. "Stripped him naked and tied his hands and feet and gagged him with a piece of dirty rag I picked out of the dump," which is just really sad. "Then I burnt his clothes, threw his shoes in the dump. Then I walked back and took the trolley to 59th Street at 2 a.m. and walked home from there. Next day at about 2 p.m., I took tools, a good heavy cat of nine tails, homemade, short handle, cut one of my belts in half, slit these half in six strips about 8 inches long. I whipped his bare behind till the blood ran from his legs."
Can you read the part about the cat nine tails again?
"I took tools, a good heavy cat of nine tails."
A good heavy cat of nine tails.
Homemade short handle.
Jesus Christ. That's like a... That's like a scourging.
It's like a whip.
It's like a... Yeah.
Yeah, I really can't read some of this. It's just too terrifying. But he did cook Billy, and he ate him. It's just so disturbing reading the details.
What year is this?
This is 1927. The murder happened.
This is somebody who acted upon these impulses without the influence of television, of video games, of any music that might glorify violence. This is somebody who had these ideas. These are pure ideas that really weren't influenced by any sort of bombardment of media. You know, because we say we hear about people, kids, youths, and young adults who perform violent acts, and we say video games are influencing them. This is a dude who had a legit psychotic streak. This is about as psychotic as it gets. He had a compulsion to send obscene letters in days before pornography. There's no Pornhub back then that he's addicted to. He's coming up with this shit in his own head on his own. He would what was the thing he... They x-rayed him and he had needles between his anus and his scrotum. 29 needles.
He loved the pain.
He loved the pain there, like in that area of your body. He was a self-masochist.
He also whipped. Yes, and he also loved his back being whipped until it bled. People do get addicted to pain.
Sure.
You're someone who's got I don't know how many tattoos, but I can imagine that you've become addicted to it.
The chemical that's released in your brain, if you have a certain amount of pain, you become addicted to it. Pain releases these endorphins in your brain. And yeah, you do become addicted to that feeling of pain, but I'm not whipping myself. I might later. I mean, I never thought of it until now.
This kind of thing comes in all shapes and sizes. Just don't let your kid go with a gray man that you don't know. I mean, this guy used to knock on his neighbor's doors and be like, hey, can I hang out with your kid? Can I take your kid to the down the street? And they would never come back.
Right. And don't let people into your house that tell you that they're going to they've been looking at you and they think that you'd make a really good model and they need to measure your curvatures and they need to measure your body because they're going to make you famous for modeling. This is why pain and tattoos specifically are addicting, because there may be an association between health and pain / tattoo craving. What pain does is primes the immune system, and then the person craves it to activate the immune system response again. So what it's doing is enhancing your immune system.
Well, do you think that's why Albert Fish did this, or we'll never know? I mean,
well, I think if we're using that kind of pseudoscientific definition of why people are addicted to pain and tattoos, and I think it's like any addiction that you do, right? If it's going to level out at some point, and then you're going to need more, and then you're going to need more. And if you have an addictive personality, I'm sure he had many personality traits that suggested that he was psychotic or had OCD. Yeah, I think if he's cutting himself one day and putting needles in between his scrotum and anus, then he's going to start whipping himself the next day. Something else that's going to take that pain to the next level, because his body's now craving it. He's priming his body for another high, another pain high.
I think we've had a pretty interesting chat tonight, Lance. And before we go, I think let's read a couple of iTunes reviews that we promised to read a while ago and never got around to it.
Yeah, we're getting around to it now.
Okay.
I used to write, you know, kind of crappy articles for my high school newspaper. I wish I could go back and do it again, but if I was, and I typically was, late on a deadline, they would replace the space in the article with this circle, and inside the circle said, "This is a round to it." And,
got it.
And that was because
good one.
That was because it was always like, oh, when are you going to get the article done? Oh, I'll get around to it. So then they would just repeat it. laughs.
True Crime Addict 87 said, Crawl Space and Missing Maura Murray are my favorite podcasts to date because of Tim and Lance. I like how he put my name first. They are genuine and really just want to bring out the facts in these cases while also putting on very captivating podcasts. Keep up the good work, guys. Thank you, True Crime Addict 87. And I'm thinking that's not James Renner.
I think most of these are James Renner. I think they put your name first because it flows better. You get the one syllable followed by it's more of a, you know, it's like a simple name, a simple one syllable name followed by what appears to be a more intriguing name.
Yeah, so whatever. How about Jess 2.5? She said, 5 stars. She said, I've been a listener of Missing Maura Murray since the beginning, and it's great to see this podcast grow in new and interesting ways. The crew is doing an excellent job with production, editing, and content. The crew is me, Lance, and sometimes Chloe. It's fantastic to see hosts that are receptive to feedback and self-criticism, which we are. Part of the appeal of the show is that the hosts allow several competing theories and cases to be discussed openly and respectfully, each on their own merits. I'm really excited to see where this podcast goes and can't wait to see the documentary. Of course, she's talking about our Maura Murray documentary that we are working on, Lance, and we're going to have a lot more information about that soon, and it's really, it's going to be awesome. Just so you know.
It's fantastic. Just looking at these stills and reliving it in my head is fun, but to see it put together in a cohesive storytelling thread is super exciting. Here's one that I want to read. It's she says, I'm assuming it's a female. The name is Mayasita. I'm hooked. 5 stars. I love this podcast. So well researched and thorough, but never boring. Tim and Lance are smart and entertaining. She's well, I guess, I mean, it doesn't have to be both of us are both smart and entertaining. It could be one is one and the other is the other. And Chloe adds another level of passion and depth thanks to her background in psychology. You can tell that these three, especially Chloe, I think Chloe might have actually written this, are deeply invested in finding the truth about what happened to Breonna Maitland. An honorable cause. Happy sleuthing. Can't wait for episode 2, which is already out there. And she's right on all accounts.
Yeah, a lot of great compliments on here, a lot of great 5-star reviews. So please give us a 5-star review on iTunes or whatever site you listen to us on. We really appreciate it.
This is a 5-star review by just a bunch of letters here. JDHDHDHAHS. These three make listening fun. I never lose interest throughout each podcast. They get their facts straight and they're honest. And besides, the podcast is for a great cause. Make sure to give them a listen and check out their Maura Murray podcast as well. I like it when people get it. Thank you so much, people, for getting it. You don't have to give the 5-star review. We appreciate it. But if you get it, then that's a win. And in addition to the live show, I think it goes without saying that Tim and myself would like to be doing this on a more full-time basis. And with the live show, income from that and income from Patreon, this is something that we can actually do, research the cases more, get more in-depth, bring you more coverage. And in the summer, maybe into the fall, there's a lot of information and a lot of material that we don't put out there. And we would like to start a Patreon and we just want to gauge the interest of whether or not this would be something that our listeners would be into supporting in the future, in the summer and in the fall, hearing additional, whether it's important information for a case or just us shooting the shit as we're doing right now. Maybe some projects that we're working on the side that have nothing to do with crime. It's more of a behind-the-scenes look, but it does support the overall cause of Crawl Space and Missing Maura Murray.
Right. I really kind of want to get drunk one night and just like shoot the shit old stories that we have because we've known each other for so long.
Right.
That we have some really ridiculous comedic stories that I think we could tell in really humorous ways. So I think that's one thing that I want to do on Patreon when we finally get that up and running, but not focus on that completely. But I think it would be kind of fun.
Right. It'd be one of the things. Wow. We've talked for an hour.
I know. We got to go.
We got to go.
Jesus. Thank you.
When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.